Welcome to this week's Escaping the Bucket. I'm Jeremy Squibb, and I'm thrilled that Terry Mullins is back with us again. How are you, Terry?
I'm fine, Jeremy. Good to see you as always.
Yeah, so we're into the new tax year, which is all exciting. Any other pivotal moments in the last couple of weeks that we've missed because we haven't been together for a while?
I don't know, mate. There's so much going on in the world that if you blink, it's like the news cycle now is one day is equal to a week. It's like we're living in dog years or something. So I really don't know, mate. I really don't know. So what's been happening in the world is just what's been happening in the world. I mean, we've got some good stuff going on, obviously, you know, getting towards the end of dealing with all the COVID stuff. So we're able to at least breathe a little bit easier.
Yeah, I mean, they had a little bit of jiggery pokery with that tanker in the Suez Canal a couple of weeks ago. So
That was fun, wasn't it? I mean, I thought I was a bad Parker, but that was kind of...
Well, it made me think about people's plans and how they can get somewhat disrupted. Because if you imagine now you're driving a tanker and you're coming up through the Suez Canal and everything's timed to, you know, pretty good perfection as far as shipping and things like that. Yeah, they've got a rough idea of when things are going to arrive. And all of a sudden, you've got this massive boat jackknifed across the canal.
Yeah.
And years ago, we went for our wedding anniversary, we went hired a canal boat. And I know how hard it is to move like a couple of ton barge once you sort of jam it into the bank and can't get it back. So, all credit to them. We managed to finally pull that off the bank. But it went in at a fair old rate by all accounts.
Well, it's not so much the getting it moving, it's the getting it to stop. And it's not so much the tanker that ran aground, it's the ones that were coming up behind, because it's not like a fender bender, is it? It's not when someone like skids on the ice and you can't stop and go into the back of someone. If you've got your tanker going into somebody else's, that can't be good. It's amazing to me. But it's like everything. That's become the byword, actually, isn't it? You know, like turning a tanker takes so many miles to turn a tanker.
It takes a lot of miles if you're trying to do it in a canal that's not
wide. Yeah, well, the things, yeah, not a lot of room to turn it either.
Oh, so, it's brilliant.
Yeah, no.
But that and, you know, the usual COVID restrictions. I mean, pleasingly for us, we're back training at football again now. So that's good. We've got the girls back on the pitch. They're all very, very excited, enthusiastic as ever. I missed it desperately. I've got to be honest, I really, really did, just to see the enthusiasm and fun. So that's good to be back at that.
I think all the sport is the same with the, the Penzance Swim Club. They're going to be back shortly. And everyone's looking forward to that. Obviously, there's restrictions. There's things we've got to do and lane restrictions, one thing or another. But when between the other lockdown, between the last lockdown and this, and the last but one lockdown and this one, that it all went really smoothly and everybody got in the swing of it. But it was just, I know for my own daughter, she can't wait to get back. And I think it's good for them, not just physically. I think it's, you know, being involved in sport, letting off a little bit of that steam as well. I think it's good for them, for their kind of their well-being. I think it's really important. So yeah. Good
and,
stuff.
And of course, in a couple of days' time, you know, as long as nothing changes in the meantime, the lockdown restrictions are eased even more. When can you start receiving visitors?
Oh, what, the Airbnb?
Yeah.
I think depending on the property, and I don't want anybody going by me on this, but I think from the 15th onwards, for certain Airbnb properties, and then I think the other one is, well, I might have it right, it might be the 12th or the 15th, but we've got bookings from the 15th anyway.
Now, of course, so you've got a few days left and just to get ready and then...
Yeah, but you can imagine what it's been like doing all this, you know, getting, you suddenly look around and you think, wow, there's a million things to do. You've got to get the yards done and the thing. So yeah, it's okay. It's good fun. And it's nice to see it all looking well again.
Oh, that'd be great. So this week we're looking at what it's like to experience financial life planning.
Right.
So just to give a sort of the overview, I did my training back in... Oh, it was the year Ellie was born. So 2012.
Right.
I did my training. So I went away and did a two-day course, which was absolutely brilliant. That was run by George Kinder. And then a couple of months later, I went back and did a five-day residential course, which again was just, it was absolutely transformational experience for me.
Life-changing, actually,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Well, if you think, it was.
Completely.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I went on one of these courses, sort of when I came home, Rachel was bracing herself for what to experience or what to expect. But, you know, she'd be the first to say, yeah, it absolutely changed me as a person and my attitudes and approaches to everything. So that was back in 2012. And then we had mentorship as well. But one of the key things that I knew was really important was to get back and practice this as quickly as possible. And of course, I was looking for some willing victims. And you came on the horizon. But I got to be honest, for me, it was really, really daunting, primarily because I knew you'd experienced so many coaching experiences and training experiences, Landmark and other stuff like that. You'd done all of these things, give such wisdom and insight and understanding, and to sort of jump into that, I was thinking, yeah, I was really apprehensive. I don't know when it was in the year. I'm really trying to think when it was in the year. I think it would probably be relatively soon after I'd done that 5-day course, which was in April. But I think I seem to recall it was raining, because I remember sitting in your armchair looking out across Mounts Bay out towards St. Michael's Mount.
Right.
That's the scene now. So I'm sitting in Terry's lovely leather armchair looking across St. Michael's Mount.
Yeah. And it's probably raining. It's almost certainly.
I think it was. I'm pretty sure it was damp. It might have been a bit foggy, I think.
There you go.
Might have been able to imagine where St. Michael's Mount was. It wasn't a sunny day anyway. I know
that. No.
And we just sort of sat down and it was a Friday. I know it was a Friday.
Crikey, that's amazing.
I'll have the date and time in a minute.
But
I can just picture these things, because I remember going back home afterwards. It was before the Olympics, because the Olympic torch came through Land's End, Penzance and all of that. And I remember driving back, listening to a big furore about a scrubland or an abandoned old motel thing. And people saying, oh, it's terrible that the camera's going to see, you know, this scrubland and all of that on international television as they're carrying the torch past it. As if the whole...
As if anybody...
It's Cornwall. Yeah. There's going to be scrubland and there's going to be abandoned buildings. So let's not get too carried away.
No.
But I remember listening to that on the radio on the way home. But what I do remember more than anything else is that you were very gentle and kind with me, which was much appreciated. But for me, I came away feeling that I'd grown during the day. But I'm really interested today. And I can wax lyrical about how I felt, which is great. But what I really want us to sort of recap, and we were chatting just before we started, what it was like for you and what it entailed and how it felt. What are your memories of the day, Ta?
Well, you have to remember, in fact, I'd go back a step and think about the Jeremy that I was, you know, got to know and become really good friends with for the couple of years before.
Yeah.
And I knew you weren't happy with what you were doing at the time. I knew that you know, you had issues around the things that you were being asked to do and the way the structure was. And it wasn't, financial planning wasn't a pleasure for you anymore. It kind of lost its shine. And I remember you weren't particularly happy with your situation at that time. And then you kind of discovered this thing. And of course, when someone discovers something, it's like when someone falls in love, you know, they bore the life out of you with it. So you were driving us nuts with it for weeks about, oh, I did this fantastic course in George Kinder and you've got to do this. And that was on and on. And of course, it's difficult for people who haven't experienced what you've experienced to get as excited about it as you. But it was lovely to see you almost come alive. You know, this is this new thing that's and it was transformational. When you see someone who's in that, you mentioned Landmark, and they talk about a thing called creating a possibility. You create a possibility for your future and then you live into that possibility, and you were like doing that. I could see you'd create a possibility for yourself here, and you were doing it. And then so when you asked me if I'd basically, as you say, be a guinea pig and do the process with you, I didn't know what to expect, didn't know what was involved. And, you know, in fairness, looking back, we were sort of preparing for this conversation, I was thinking, gosh, that was a long time ago. And of course, we didn't then proceed with the procedure. You know, we didn't kind of do the life planning afterwards. You know, I didn't employ you. You didn't do all the things you did. I kind of wonder now if I had where I'd be. I'd probably be a lot better off than I am now. But what we did do was we went through the initial process. And you were saying about how it was a bit daunting for you and all that for whatever reason. But it wasn't daunting for me when I started, because I thought it was a conversation. It was going to have a conversation. You were going to basically try some stuff out and see how it worked. What I didn't expect was how affected it was, and how I found it such a moving experience. And very, you know, very revealing for me personally. So I enjoyed the process. Now, of course, as you've just said, it's like 9 years ago or something. That's such a long time ago.
Coming on for 9 years ago, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the specifics about the day and what we did and one thing or another have, you know, that's kind of dissipated a bit, and it's gone into memory, some of it. And so, but there are key points along the process which I'll probably always remember, because they were really, and some of the conclusions and some of the visions we created and things like that, you know, I still have those in my mind now. So that it was really powerful. And given that, I don't know if I was the first person you tried it on, but given it was very early days, it was, I think a lot of it, you know, not taking away from you, but it speaks to the power of the material, that it works even when you've got someone who's not massively enrolled in doing it, just doing it for a friend, and someone who's just started it out, and yet you still manage to get that effect out of it. You know, if someone comes to it as someone who wants to actively participate, they're looking for changes in their lives and things, and given the experience you've got now, I can only imagine what it must be like for someone going through the process now.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things you mentioned there was really interesting, was that to see someone so enthused, and you're thinking, God, this is like someone who's just had this switch flicked, and because you hadn't gone through it, it was difficult to understand where this enthusiasm had come from. That was one of the massive warnings that we had emphasized into us as we left that especially the 5-day residential one, because that was just this cocoon of, I mean, it's a beautiful place in Dorset, Gaunt's House, which is run by a community. It's all vegetarian or vegan food. They do, you know, let you go out on the Thursday night to go to the pub, so you can have a you know, big juicy steak if you need one. But it was just, you're in this cocoon, and you woke up in the morning, we all had breakfast together on the course. Then we all worked on our life plans with our partners, with the group, right the way through. We then had lunch together, and then we worked in the afternoon. Then we had our evening meal together, and we carried on working. And by the end of each day, it's about 8:30, 9 o'clock. Everyone was exhausted, fast asleep, up again early the next morning. It was a beautiful retreat, but a real intense experience. So for us then to be warned, when you go home, do not go bouncing through the door, because your spouse hasn't experienced what you've just experienced over the last week. Also, do not do this on your spouse, because, and as we'll find out as we work through in a moment, but if you do this on your spouse, if you try to work this way on your spouse, you may well find that you're some of the issues. And that's really hard to sit and listen to, which it is hard to listen to, isn't it?
Or they might edit. They could as well edit, you know, their responses, couldn't they? Because
absolutely, yeah.
Not wishing to upset you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I managed to suppress my excitement for about 10 minutes as I came through the door.
It wasn't actually on the day. It was a very professional presentation. The way you did it was very professional. It was actually the weeks before, you know, when you'd done the courses and you were just... And it was completely understandable. I've done that. I've been on transformational courses, and, you know, I've been on courses that people, you know, try to pretend are cults and things like that. And, you've been brainwashed and all that. And my point was, well, you know what? My brain needed a bit of washing, frankly. It was a little bit grubby there and I needed sorting out. So, but no, because when people see, people have, it's very much actually the escaping the bucket philosophy, isn't it? Because the minute you kind of start behaving in a way that people don't expect, it doesn't matter how positive it is and how good it is, and how they would even benefit from what you're doing. It's just the fact, well, this isn't Jeremy anymore, or this isn't Terry anymore. They're not who we thought they were.
That is so true, and not a story for today, but another time when we're going a bit deeper. I experienced that in a number of different ways, which then really emphasised that escape in the bucket conversation that we had in that car park in Penzance. and there were various elements in my life which all of a sudden they weren't as important, or I didn't hold those people in such high esteem as I had before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd realized what was really important. And I think that's the key part of this work, is to find your real purpose, find your real possibility using that approach. And that's something that we cover off in another workshop that Tina runs as well, which is, you know, again, brilliant. Yeah. Overall for me, it was just this opportunity to have the confidence in having the conversations with people that I really wanted to have with people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess that's a good place for us to start today is some of the work. I can't remember if you completed it in advance or whether I don't think you did. I think we just sat down and spoke about it.
Sure.
So from 9:30 or whenever we started that day, we would have started with the first of the three questions. We've covered them on the podcast before, but it's worth mentioning them again now. So question one, and these are all attributed to the Kinder Institute and George, and I'm sure that he'll enjoy listening to these as well. You have all the money you could possibly need, both now and in the future. You have no financial worries or concerns whatsoever. How would your life look? Dream big. Just go wild. How would it look?
I remember when you asked me that question, I don't know if these things change over time, because if you're asking me that question today, I'm in a different place. And you were just saying a moment ago how you felt nervous, and I can understand why, because these are not questions that financial advisors, your typical IFA, doesn't normally start in this place, especially when I know where the other two questions are going to take you, and you did.
Yeah.
So that's kind of it. So I remember looking at it, and then, you know, what I went into, I think, was obviously, first of all, knowing my family were all secure and everything's safe. And, you know, at that time, Amy was quite small. She was about four, I think, four, maybe five, no more. So, you know, and it was that was a second family for me. So I had all that. So the idea that all of that's secure, everything's safe, I don't have to worry about any of that. And then you start thinking, well, you know, I could look at some of the selfish stuff. I've traveled a lot, but I'd like to travel more. Mm-hmm. I've read a lot, but I'd like to read more. And when I say read more, I mean more about sort of like studying and following through on studying. And I think that came up because it's always been a passion of mine. You know, I'm always interested in what I know, but it's the stuff I don't know. And more, even more interesting is the stuff I don't know, I don't know. And that, you know, I really kind of want to get into that. So that would have certainly come up. And, you know, and I think as well on a kind of material level, we were talking about where would I live, what would I do, and that sort of stuff. So I think I wanted to, as I recall, because it's always been something I wanted, was a hilltop house, you know, high up on a hill, fairly secluded, modern design, plenty of glass, overlooking the sea. And, yeah, that was stuff along those lines. So it was my personal my personal wish list, because I know you're a dad and you know what it's like. We some people might disagree with this, but we do tend to put ourselves second or third in line or fourth in line. We make sure everything else is okay first before we start feeling, well, I'll spoil myself a bit, I'll do that, I'll do this. And I think being freed up from that and knowing that everything's in hand and taken care of would allow me to be a little bit more selfish in a kind of good way, selfish in making the best of myself. So I think, you know, that was the kind of conversation we were having with that question. And it only got harder, didn't it?
Well, it did. I mean, the key thing I should caveat all of this was, when we work with clients, we don't just sit down and say, right, today I'm going to ask you three questions and we go straight into it.
No.
That normally would come in maybe a second or third meeting, because there's a lot of pre-work that needs to happen, which is, it's really like clearing the decks. So all the baggage that we carry with us that's stopped us moving forward up to now, if we don't actually deal with that first, then that baggage is still going to be there. We can create the most wonderful dream and vision ever for somebody, but if they're still held back by all the baggage and all the assumptions and the innocent beliefs, which is something that Russell Davis covered off a couple of weeks ago, if we're all held back by that, then it doesn't matter what shining beacon of the future we show. No one's going to move forward. So that sort of caveats, that's pre-work before we get to these three questions. But for the purposes of what we went through on that day, I just wanted to practice this stuff because it was so important. So that was question one. And what I found really interesting from that was, yes, you wanted a nice house on the hill overlooking the sea and modern. And we described it in a lot of depth as well. I remember there's a lot of glass in front of it. And what really hit home, that was really the only materialistic, that was the only tangible thing. There was no, I want to go on a world cruise, I want to do all these, I want a Ferrari in the driveway, none of that nonsense. And I think it's testament to you and the experiences you've had in the past was that you understand that if you suddenly had a pot of wealth and money wasn't an issue, it's about how you would live your life.
Yeah.
And what you could do to bring maximum value to you in your heart, in your soul, and those around you, as opposed to, I'll just have, eight sovereign rings on my fingers and that sort of stuff.
Well, you hear of people, don't you, all the time who come into sudden wealth, maybe young people who get it very young, or people who inherit it, they're born into it. Or you get people who have a big, Euro Millions win or something like that. And you see how it actually becomes a tremendous burden, because I don't know actually why, but it becomes this issue of, well, I've got to spend this money now. I've got to have this particular life because I've got this money. Obviously it makes a lot of people very happy, but it's a lot of people it doesn't. And I'm always surprised how many of them, and it's quite tragic, how many of these really young influencers, as they're called, these fairly young people, maybe in their teens or in their early 20s, and they just go down a completely wrong path, and quite often you even hear them taking their own lives. I mean, you can imagine someone taking an overdose because of excess, but to take your own life means that you're not very happy. You're very unhappy. Yeah. And there must be something about, and I think when you've had a few years, you've got a few miles on the clock, when you know that, it's almost, I've had money and I've lost money and I've had money, and it's nicer to have the money for sure, but it's never been the source of happiness. It's certainly never been a source of joy, and that's the two things are very different.
It's really interesting actually. When Russell was on a couple of weeks ago, one of the things he said I wrote down was, the more we are comfortable not having money, the more we'll be able to make money.
Yeah, and that's
that freedom. And I mean, your experience in the past with the people you've worked with, that all of a sudden, once they hit their sales target, they'll sell 10 times more.
Absolutely.
The answer is probably, and this was alluded to a couple of weeks ago, remove the sales targets altogether.
Absolutely.
And then there's no pressure. But I think, one of the key things is the person with no investments whatsoever never gets upset when the stock market drops. You've not got a penny invested, it doesn't impact on you.
No, of course. And in fact, we all saw it with COVID, didn't we? I mean, there's terrible things happening all around the world all the time. Mm. But when it comes home, when it really starts to impact on you, then you start to realize really what's important. So I think the temptation would be to just list things that you want and all that. But I've never been much good at that, frankly. And, I'm the worst person to buy a present for, because I can't think of anything I want. And they know that. So as a consequence, they don't get me a lot. No, they get me stuff that is just, that it's neither here nor there. At one time, all I ever got for pretty well every time was book tokens, because they knew they were safe with that. Give him plenty of money to go into Waterstones and he's happy as Larry. And frankly, that's probably true. So yeah, it wasn't really, for me, it wasn't about accumulating lots of wealth. It was about the security that comes with money. Yeah. That would be really appreciated.
And I think the ability to be benevolent as well.
Yeah. That did come up as well, because I one of the things, if money really was no object and it was limitless, I always had this idea. My mum had quite a hard life, and I always thought it'd be really nice to have done so. She loved children, and I've always donated to, or you know, of course, through my life, I've donated to Great Ormond Street, hospital. And because it's a children's hospital, and it would have been really nice to have put something in a Great Ormond Street with her name on it, you know, just dedicated to her. That would be serious money, of course, very serious money. But, you know, the premise of your question is that I had very serious money. So, you know, having a ward, or a kind of maternity ward or something like that in her name would have been, that would have been a fulfillment of a dream for me. So yeah, stuff like that, I think, came up in the conversation.
Yeah, and I think from memory, it's just flooding back now. From memory, that was the point where you walked into the restaurant in Newlyn, and there was an image of this, and they were presenting you for saying thank you for donating, being able to donate, having walked down the hill from the house on the hill.
Into this
lovely restaurant looking out over the sea.
I think we talked about the one in Mousel, wasn't it? We were talking about the old Coast Guard, which is a beautiful restaurant.
It was,
and that's a beautiful place. And just going in there as a family and drinking a toast to my mum. It was a lovely moment. And it's just really funny how when you move out of yourself, when you stop worrying about what do I want, it becomes emotional. And even now, as I'm telling it now, I can feel myself getting a little bit emotional about it. So it's these are real things that come up when you allow yourself the freedom to dream, really.
I think that's it. I mean, the second question sort of moves emotion a little bit further. And just to warn anyone listening, the emotion level does get ramped up as we get to question.
Yeah, it only gets worse, yeah.
But question two is actually, again, beautifully reflective. And it goes along the lines of, you go to visit your doctor and he tells you the sad news that you've got 5 years to live. You'll live a perfectly healthy life, but then you will not have notice of your death. So it's basically, you know, let's paraphrase that as, you see the doctor, he says, actually, you've got a heart condition. You're going to live for at least 5 years. That's not a problem, but we won't know when you will actually die. With that, if you knew that you have at least 5 years and we don't know how long after that particular date, if you knew that now, how would you change your life? What would your priorities be?
See, now, when you asked me that question, because that was like 10 years ago, I would have been in my mid-50s. Now I'm in my mid-60s. So when you're asking someone in their mid-60s that question, it's very real because, you know, I mean, I don't know what the national average for life expectancy for a UK man. I'm pretty fit and well, but you never know. So suddenly you're talking about 5 years, which is obviously a short span. I'm hoping I can get through at least 5 years. But you know, you ask, your mortality becomes very real to you once you get past sort of like 65 or something. I mean, it was quite shocking to me to get a pension, you know, like suddenly the government's sending me a pension. I thought, that's for old people. I don't need a pension, you know, because I've never perceived, I've never seen myself in that way. But the world sees you in a different way, and you get people.
Yeah, they do. I think I become eligible for SAGA in about 3 weeks' time.
I remember getting upset when I couldn't go on a Club 1830 holiday. You know, that doesn't seem that long ago. So you get beyond that. And now, you know, when you're past your 30s, I'm over 30 now. I can't go on a Club 1830 holiday. Not that I would ever have gone on a Club 1830 holiday, but it was nice to have the choice. The thing about acknowledging your own mortality, it becomes something that you're aware of all the time. Mm. You know, being mistaken for Amy's granddad when she was a baby was not an unusual occurrence. And so stuff like that, I had all that to deal with. But so it would probably be a different set of answers now. And in truth, I don't remember in any great detail how I felt about it then. But I mean, the point was, not much would have changed, because I still would have, been aware if the money situation was the same, that I could still do the things I needed, but you'd clearly want to spend more time. Now I've got a daughter in Australia and a grandson with another one on the way in Australia. So the answer now would be different. You know, I'd want to be spending as much time with them as possible and family. And that's the kind of difference. I think happiness is this thing you get on occasions. You get these moments of happiness, and they can be brought about because your football team's won a good match, or you're at a kid's recital, or you hear a particularly beautiful bit of music and you can be happy. Joy is a different thing. Joy is something that is a softer thing. It's a contentment that comes from knowing everything's as it should be and it's okay. So coming to terms with it, I think, you know, we're all terminal, you know, we're all going to die. And as you get nearer to it, you're more aware of it, but it's the same. And, you know, mentioning Tom, and I know God, thank God he's better now, but you know, you never know in the midst of life, you know, as they say, you with death, you never know what's going to happen. So you have to make sure those things are in place. But of course, the premise of the first question allowed that to be the case. Everything's in place. So now I can just relax. So the things that are important to you, you'd still want to make sure that you did the best with your life and maybe achieve some of those things that you always said you would, but you never did, you know, those regrets. But really, I think it's – and the idea of saying, well, I'd spend more time with my family, well, really – perhaps you would, but maybe you wouldn't. I mean, you want to be around, you know, maybe that wouldn't be the best way. It wouldn't be good for them, because the two contradicting expressions, you know, that absence makes the heart grow fonder, familiarity breeds contempt, you know, completely opposite.
Well, I think that's been true over lockdown for a lot of people.
Well, this is it, isn't it? Yeah, so, you know, we've spent a lot of time with our family in the last year. So I'm not saying I wouldn't do that, but making sure that everybody I love knows I love them would be really important. And I think we take so much for granted, don't we? And I think this year has shown us that. We take so much for granted that if we don't every now and again just stop to tell the people we love that we love them, you know, and it, you know, I'm of a different generation. My mum was very loving. My dad, I can't remember my dad ever saying he loved me. I knew he did love me, but he never said it. Mm. Nowadays, I can't get through a day without telling my kids I love them. It's just a different world now. But I think knowing that it's, you know, being really aware it's finite, that it's going to happen within 5 years, but you'll be fine, but you won't know it's coming. It'll just be like that. I guess that would make it a very much more, bring a point to it. You'd really look at it and think, I need to speak to that person. And also, and this is something else that the guys, when I did that landmark program you mentioned earlier, getting things complete.
Yeah.
There's so many, you know, how people that you've upset or you're having stupid arguments with that have gone on for years. You know, there were people on some of these programs where they hadn't spoken to their brother for 5 years and they couldn't even remember what it was about. Mm. It's just, but oh, why should I go to him? He should come to me and all that, you know? And you just start thinking, I haven't got time for that. I need to get that cleaned up. It's a shame we don't have that present for us all the time. Yeah. Getting those things complete.
I think what I noticed from it, and I notice this a lot from the clients I work with as well, is that second question gives a level of intention of there are things that I need to do, I want to do, a sense of priority. Yeah, you know, we've spoken a lot about time, where your time goes and how you allocate it. And a really great exercise that actually is included in you know, this way of working as well, is that you list down your existing day. And after you've done all this reflective work, you then list down your ideal day or your ideal week or your ideal year. And you start to compare the two. Actually, here's where all my time goes. It's an exercise I do with clients because there's 96 15-minute segments in each day.
Okay.
96, which is near enough to 100 for percentage-wise. You know, you lose, you know, four of them for sitting on the loo or looking on your phone or whatever. If you can then start to monitor where my time has gone in percentage terms each day compared to where I want to spend it, if you do that for a couple of weeks and then you go back and think, okay, let's have a look at this now. I spent, I don't know, 20% of my week doing this thing with those people that I don't really enjoy, but it's a habit. And I'm afraid to move out of the bucket to do something different because they'll pull me back in again. That was where I was. There was things that I was doing that I thought, why am I doing this? And why am I doing it for these people? When I know, having worked through these questions and this reflective work, they are not really the priority, but it's the habit that we've slipped into.
Mm-hmm.
Just that way of doing stuff.
I think it's that, isn't it? It's taking that moment to recognize, I know everybody says it, but how lucky we are. I tell you what I've noticed, on Amazon and Netflix and all that, they're just wall-to-wall dystopian, apocalyptic programs, series of people, terrible disasters happening to the world and everything changes. And I was watching one, and I don't know why they're so, especially at the time, we've just gone through, why anyone would watch them, but they're very popular. So I watched one recently, can't remember what it was called, but it was a Russian one, dubbed, obviously. And, if you can imagine a Russian dystopian apocalyptic kind of series, that's serious stuff. That's hardcore. Yeah. And anyway, these people, they're trying to exist. And at one point, about four, five episodes in, it's all snowy and freezing, as you would imagine. They find this cottage, and the cottage is just falling apart. But they go in, and there's a fire. It's not lit, but there's a big fire there. They can get the fire going. They find tins of food in the larder. Now, when the program started, these people were all wealthy people driving around in lovely cars and beautiful apartments. But when they went in there and obviously discovered this was just the most wonderful thing. Now, and as I'm watching it, I'm thinking it as well. I say, wow, that's a bit of luck. They can have a fire and they can cook some beans or something. And you just realize when you watch these things, you know what? When it comes down to it, you've really got to have the fundamentals in place. If you haven't got those in place, then your priorities just shift massively. And there was another one I saw where the people finally found somewhere they had running water and they could have a shower. And, things that we just take for granted. And then you suddenly get them back and you think, oh, just isn't it wonderful? And it happened with the lockdown, being able to kind of go out and meet people, albeit limited, and have people come to your home, albeit limited. We suddenly start appreciating stuff that we didn't even take for granted. It was just wallpaper. We didn't even notice it.
Mm.
And now, I think, that 5-year question is very pointed and kind of wakes you up a bit. It's like a bucket of cold water.
Yeah, I used to feel it was maybe the weaker of the three questions, but actually the more I've worked around it, I think it really gives people a sense of direction and energy and urgency because none of us know where we are on this 5-year horizon. We may be miles away from it. We may be halfway through it. We may be really, really close to the end of it. We just don't know.
You just don't know.
No. So question three, it goes along the lines of, you go back to the doctor and he shocks you with the news that you only have one day to live.
Mm.
With that knowledge, now what's changed? What got missed? What didn't you get to do or be? The key thing with this question isn't what would you do in 24 hours? Because people say, 24 hours, I'll go out and party, or I'll fly here, or I'll do that. We won't fly anywhere at the moment, but we'd do all these things and say all these things. That's not the point. It's not what would you do in those 24 hours. But if you knew that tonight, when your head hit the pillow and your eyes shut, they're never going to open again and that's it, what never got done? What regrets were there? What got missed?
Yeah, I remember when we did this one and you were saying about the weakest of the questions. I actually always thought this was the weakest of the questions because it's the least realistic in a sense. You could be told that you had a 5-year illness, that it's going to be deep, you're going to get whatever. You can get that as a reality. The idea that you won't wake up. And I know what you're saying. What are the most important things to get done? And I think to a degree, I sort of covered that in the 5-year one. What do you do? I pick up the phone and phone my daughter and tell her I love her again. but I'd have done that yesterday anyway. Yeah. I give Maria a kiss and tell her I love her, and we have a cuddle and that.
But I think that the key thing here is it's not what would you do, it's what never got done. What are the things you've always promised yourself that you do? I mean, the book, one of the books that I've got referred to a lot is Bronnie Ware's The Top Five Regrets of the Dying, which she spends time with cancer patients in Australia and discusses with them the lessons that they've learned and what they wish they could then impart to others, what they wish they knew sooner, because they're on a one-way track. Yeah, they're not going to get better. They're not going to be able to do anything different. And it's really interesting, because I think by reflecting on this question, all of a sudden it makes us realize, actually, if I was in that position now, maybe what relationships are there that have been damaged and are not put right? Or what are the things that I wish I could continually say to my children? Or, maybe there's something that I'd always really wanted to do and just never got to. What would be taken away from me?
Mm.
Maybe that's it.
I think what would be taken away is your voice. And because of that, given the constructs of one day, I think in reflection, I mean, I'd be very aware of the things that haven't got done. It's like everything, a couple of weeks back when we were talking about when things are incomplete, you don't have to look for them. They're always, right there. And I think on a bigger scale, on a bigger picture, that would be the same with this. I think what I would probably do is spend the day writing letters, because I think, just the constriction of that one day limits what you can do in terms of seeing the people you need to see, speaking to the people you need to see. So maybe just doing the old thing of putting pen to paper and writing to those people and letting, so that your voice would carry on after you, maybe to clean up some of the stuff you left behind.
Yeah.
In terms of events, it's not that there wouldn't be places I hadn't seen or books I hadn't read, because there will, always will. It'd be the fact that I'd only got one day to do it in. So I think, maybe...
So as we're sat here right now, if I said in 5 minutes' time, that's it, I hope this doesn't happen, because it'll ruin the recording.
Absolutely.
In 5 minutes' time, you're keeling over. That's the end of that.
Right.
You're going to die. Knowing that now, what is there that's undone?
I haven't left a legacy, but I can't leave a legacy in 5 minutes. But I haven't done that. I actually think that it might be an arrogance, but I think that the work, the stuff I do, deserves to carry on. And at the moment, I'm just trying to put a legacy in place. At the moment, I'm trying to get the thing, done in form, so that other people can benefit from it going forward. So that's what I would want to do. That would be the regret. I certainly wouldn't solve it. But now let me throw that one back to you. You're in that scenario. You've got your 5 minutes. What hasn't been done? Not so easy now, is it?
It's not. It's far from easy. I think a set of, I wouldn't be able to do it in 5 minutes, but I'd always thought,
I think you're, isn't it just that we're after the awareness of
I'd always thought if I knew that my life was limited a lot shorter than what I anticipate, I would want to record videos for my daughters for those key moments in their lives, for their 18th birthday, for the day they get married, for when they first have a child, that they can just get this back up, and that so as they go through life, they can just enforce that memory or reinforce that memory that here's some words of hopeful wisdom from Dad, and it'll mean a lot.
I mean, that's
and I think in a way it's very similar to what you said. It's almost like a legacy. It's not a legacy from an ego point of view. I don't want to build a big mausoleum on top of a hill or have a squib towers or anything like that. Certainly don't want a golf course in Scotland and set up my own social media channel. None of that nonsense. But I think what I'd like to do is to think that through the hard work and all the accumulation of wealth and insight that I've encountered through the various places I've been, that somehow I could wrap some of that up and impart some of the good bits of me to others so that it can carry on.
Well, of course, we have the technology to do that now, and a lot of people do that. I kind of wonder a bit about it. I mean, you know, your daughter's getting married and they've got to watch the dead dad video. I'm not sure that's going to be the high spot of the day. You know, we'll have the toast and then we'll bring my dead father out and he'll give us some words of wisdom. I'm not sure that's such a great idea. But, you know, I get what you're saying. I really do. Do you know what? It's interesting.
I think overall, I'd want them to know that I absolutely adore them and the most important people.
I'm pretty sure they know that, Jeff. I'm pretty sure, having met them, I'm pretty sure. And yeah.
You wouldn't say that during the trumpet lessons and piano lessons. No, no, no. Sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, Amy's brutally honest with me. The stuff she comes out with is kind of like, oh, please don't, you know. She puts me in my place and it's wonderful. But
I tell you what, though, you flipping the question back, it really made me think that I was working with some clients recently and we revisited their three questions from 6-7 years ago. And that's the key thing. And this sort of leads on to where we're going now for the rest of today. But it's really about, you can have all these great intentions and this great experience. And it's as you said at the start, well, we never followed through with anything. So people get hugely energized, but if they don't carry on that journey, don't put a plan into place and actually are accountable for it, then it's just been a great experience. So at the end of all of this, you know, I then brought all of those key things together, which culminated in walking down the hill into the old Coast Guard. And there was this evening where, you know, the presentation from Great Ormond Street was there. And you know, all of those things, that pivotal moment. And the next question was, what could stop this happening?
Well, I'm in a fortunate position because I've had 8 years of I can actually just tell you what's happened in the last 8 years to stop it happening. Now, the truth is that the only thing that ever stops anything happening, I think, is the intention. You lose sight of the intention. And this is why I was saying right at the beginning that what we did was an exercise, a one-day exercise, which highlighted really the power of what it is you do very clearly. But at that time, neither you nor I were in a position to follow that forward and do something with it. So now, someone taking it up now, the difference is they'd have the roadmap.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you, it's not actually that you lay out the roadmap for people, because I know how you work. It's more that you, between you and the people, you discover the road. You discover the road they should take, and you make sure that you signpost it for them. Now, if the thing that would stop anyone getting to where they want to go, really, the only thing I think is that they don't have that support and they don't have that guidance and they don't have someone calling them to account. Because if you don't have someone saying, "Well, you know, did you follow up on that? Did you do that? Is that still important to you, or are you going to let that go?" If you haven't got someone who's saying that to you while looking after all the nuts and bolts stuff that will make it happen as well, then it ain't going to happen. And so it doesn't. And that's really what it is. I think where the difference, I think, between life planning and financial advice hinges on that. Yeah. Because financial advice is just about, let's put the money in place. Right, let's get the biggest yield. How much risk are you willing to take, and all that sort of stuff, which is all really important. And I know you deal with all of that, but it doesn't. It isn't. You're not. You're planning. What you're doing is planning a retirement. You're not planning a life, and planning a life starts now, doesn't it? So, you know, that's kind of the difference for me. So the biggest obstacle really is the participant themselves, if they are not supported and not just on the day, but going forward.
It's really interesting hearing that, because I cast my mind back to the 11th of November, 2011. pivotal day, 11-11-11. Mm-hmm. Hey, what was pivotal about that, apart from this, you know, it was Armistice Day? I went to a conference, one of the Financial Society conferences that, like the one that well, a couple of the ones that you've spoken at when we've been up there together. And I went with the intention of this particular conference of writing down notes, but actually allocating time to take action on them. So obviously I'd have shared some of your wisdom in the meantime to actually allocate time to do stuff. So that's the first thing. And whereas usually I'd go on a conference, write down a bunch of notes, come back with a conference pack, put it in the drawer, find it next year when I go on the next conference, and nothing's done. So I'd had a great experience, brilliant couple of days at conference, lovely, but never ever done anything with it. You know, it's just like a good meal that you have and think, oh, that was a good meal, and it's 24 hours later it's done. And I think that for many people, I'm pretty sure there's many people listening will be recognizing that now and thinking, the number of times I've either had a really good experience, I've read a book for the content but not for the intent. There's a huge difference there, the intent, and what are you actually going to get and learn out of this book, and what you're going to do from it, but also from courses as well and experiences like that. So what I really committed to this was, when I come back, I'm going to look at all my notes and I'm going to put these things into action. And there are a few really good sessions that I went to. One was a guy called Dave Scarlett, really good friend, just visionary stuff, which now seems obvious, but back then it was absolutely visionary. And the other key one was Tina Weeks. And I saw Tina speak about this financial life planning, and I heard a little bit about it, but didn't really know what it was. But I committed to then follow this up. And it's absolutely terrifying for me to think, I'll email this person who's spoken about this with such authority, who's obviously an industry leader, a visionary, who the hell am I to ask for their help? But I did. And then we had a conversation, and then that led from one thing onto another. But it was the fact that I had somebody there to guide and support me, somebody who I didn't know until I reached out either. That's the important thing. But if it wasn't for Tina's support and encouragement to encourage me to take the next step and the next step and the next step, I mean, as we know, you know, within 18 months, I'd walked out of one door and walked into the Serenity door.
Absolutely.
Through the Serenity door.
I mean, that whole thing about, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher turns up, I think it's absolutely true. Yeah.
The whole thing with all of that was, and still is, this ongoing development, ongoing support, ongoing encouragement to keep moving along that journey. And I think that's what a lot of people lose. And it's the same with people who no doubt do go to some of your courses, one of your courses, absolutely brilliant, 10 new clients course, people go on that, bouncing off the walls, oh, I'm going to get 10 new clients. If they don't do the follow-up, they won't get any new clients.
No.
Just the fact. So I think, as you said, from my perspective, the reason why I'm doing what I am doing today is because I followed through and kept in contact and kept the support. But a lot of people will spend an awful lot of money on a course or an experience, but then shy away from the ongoing support and the ongoing work because they're, oh, I don't want to pay for that on an ongoing basis. I don't want to commit to this subscription or whatever else.
Mm.
But that's where the work really happens.
Mm.
Yeah, just Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan until they get a smack in the face.
Exactly.
And right. That's the thing. You can have the best plan in the world, but if you don't follow it through, if you don't have the support, that conscience to make sure you're moving forward, you know, sure as eggs is eggs, you'll look around in 5-10 years' time and none of it will have happened.
Well, that's how all coaching works, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're watching a fantastic tennis player, and you're seeing his coach sitting in the stands and he's kind of deferring to the coach every now and then, looking up to make sure he's doing it okay. He's a better tennis player than the coach. Otherwise, the coach would be on the court. But he needs someone to see where he's going wrong and or to keep him on track. And it's not that much different from a consultant who's with the right mindset. Yeah. You know, if you're just measuring success by the percentage growth in your trust fund every year, that's great. But if you're not doing anything with it, then you know, what about the percentage growth in who you are? You know, that's really way more important. So personal growth in the course of a year is way more important. You should write that down.
I'm going to nab that. That's gold dust. That's absolute gold dust.
I saw you pick up the pen. I couldn't resist it. I'm sorry.
As with every single interaction we've ever had, there's always a word of wisdom that comes deep from within. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you. So just looking back now, just briefly now, over 10 years, has anything massively changed?
No, loads of things have massively changed. I mean, I'm a far happier person than I was 10 years ago. And financially, I'm more secure. I'm better off for sure. And the funny part is, and it was funny when we were talking about the house on the hill, overlooking the bay. I've actually got a house on the hill overlooking the bay. I always have had. Yeah. And that's really strange that it isn't made of glass, but what I've done with the house and one thing or another, it's pretty spectacular, as you alluded to in the past. So I've pretty well got a lot of what I was after. I didn't follow through for the reasons we just discussed, but it was still a real moment. And interestingly, it was an Olympic year. I've forgotten that, because it's all about passing the torch, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's like, yeah. You know, and that's, you know, that's the kind of metaphor that you guys use. You light a torch and then you pass it to someone to carry on. And that's absolutely right. So it was a really good experience, a really enjoyable experience. And it did resonate with me. And, you know, there aren't many days that I can remember from 8 years ago or 9 years ago, you know, in any detail, but I remember that one, yeah. You know, in quite a lot of detail. So, it was very impactful.
Yeah. No, that's great to hear. And, you know, if anyone wants any more insight, you know, ping us an email. It's jeremy@escapingthebucket.com. And, you know, we can just share some more stuff, point you in the right direction. There's so many great resources or for a conversation, then, you know, always open for that. But I think that actual meeting, it's interesting how much floods back. And I think I'm pretty sure this is how much detail can flood back from a memorable experience. We had bacon sandwiches for lunch.
Yeah, but
they were bacon sandwiches with salad inside. On granary bread.
That sounds like the sort of thing Maria would do. But you've always been way too interested in the food side. The catering's always. I mean, you were talking about the events and talking about the catering. Yeah, it's the catering isn't what it's about. But yeah, they were nice sandwiches. I remember that.
They were excellent. Yeah, no, it's just really. I just savor that day so much. I think partly the company, partly the experience, partly the opportunity to learn. I really took that away, that opportunity to learn and share the knowledge of you know what I'd experienced, but also to pick up some more words of wisdom from yourself. That was wonderful. So that's pretty much it for this week. Next week I've got another good friend of mine. He's on because you're going to be up to your eyes with Airbnb for a couple of weeks.
I don't actually have that much to do with the Airbnb, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
So Chris is going to be on. Chris runs Lacuna Wheels, and we're going to be talking about lasting powers of attorney, why you need one. So that's going to be quite interesting. Basically, putting yourself in control of who's making the decisions for you. That's power of attorney is.
In actual fact, that might be something you do in that last 12 hours, isn't it? You suddenly I better sort out those powers of attorney pretty quick.
Well, it'd be too late with 12 hours. but the will that we're going to talk about the week after, that might be one of them. But Terry, thanks again for your
real pleasure.
Your company. Hopefully you'll be back in another couple of weeks. We'll pick up and have some more insightful topics and discussions then.
Great stuff. Thanks, mate.
Take care.